on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Very good evening to you all, wherever you may be. Welcome along to another edition of the Orient Hour here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Andy Gilson. In the studio, we've got Barry Galvin, the club's PA, and joining us, hopefully, if all the buttons are working, hopefully joining us on the phone as well will be Barry Hearn, if he's there. Good evening, Barry.
Good evening, sir. How are you?
Very good. Well, that's the most earliest that anyone's ever rung in. You know that.
Well, I'm so excited because now I've semi-retired. I've got nothing else to do, Andy, so I might as well speak to you.
Well, thank you. I'll take that as a compliment. That's it's the nicest thing you've ever said to me, you know that.
It's probably true.
Yeah, yes. And I'm just going to introduce the panel so that you know who's at the other end. We've got Darren Burrows and Barry Galvin. I think you know Barry, who does all the announcing at the club, and Joe Durston and myself. So we've got some questions for you, obviously, from the fans as well to be answered. And obviously, none of us have seen much this season, Barry, so you're no different. You haven't had much chance to have a look at the club.
No, I've been down once, and, you know, it's a mixture of me being very busy doing a lot of other things, and frankly, being a year like we haven't had. I mean, in my own business, COVID, as you can imagine, in the sports business, has been a major obstacle to overcome. So I'm looking forward now, hopefully, as we get back to normality, to being down there a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as I say, it's one game more than some of us have seen, actually, that you've managed to get to. Overall, just an oversight from your overview, do you think it was a missed opportunity this season, perhaps?
I find it frustrating. In life, I don't generally look back on anything with regret, because once it's happened, I can't see a lot of point, you know. I've always looked forward, and whatever we got because that's what we deserve to get. Absolutely, we don't achieve anything by wishing, you know, we all wished we'd have spent £100 million on players, and, you know, was that a missed opportunity? So it's you've got to take it in perspective of the job in hand, and it's a tough job, and it's a rebuilding exercise. As long as the basic principles of what you're doing is right, eventually the results will come. I mean, I know it's not what fans want to hear, but in a business sense, the bricks have got to be placed in the right order in the basement before you put the roof on. And I think it was a year of progress, maybe not fast. A missed opportunity? No, I wouldn't say it's a missed opportunity. I think everything's there for a reason. But I think, hopefully, you know, optimism always burns brightly at the Orient, and we seem to shoot ourselves in the foot a few times, but the club's in very good hands, and I think there's some optimism for the future. I never look about. If I ever missed an opportunity, the fact that I've missed it means I never want to think about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, at the moment, we're all waiting for the white smoke to rise above the football ground at the moment with the election of a new manager. You get all these names mentioned, and we get fed information as do a lot of people. And we all think that we know who it is, but is it taking too long, or is this just a due diligence process that you think
it's a due diligence process? I mean, there's ways of conducting interviews. I think that the club, as I say, I'm quite a fan of the owners. I make that quite clear. I think they're good people. And I think they're determined to do it right, and that does not involve rushing, because it's a major appointment. You know, we look back over the last few years, and we've had some really terrific people involved in the club, from the managerial side downwards. I wouldn't criticise any of them. They played the cards they were dealt, and they did the very best, and they were sincere, genuine people. So, enough said. But I think there is also an argument, especially from an owner's perspective, of this is great. You know, everybody loves Lake Norien, and we love Lake Norien, but we want success. And we are in a results business. And sometimes you have to look back on a few more basic principles. Get rid of that phone.
Yeah. You have to always turn your phone off when you're on radio.
Principles of experience and who's ticked boxes, who's done the job before. Because eventually, even the most patient owner, and I was pretty patient over 19 years, we are, although we won't admit it publicly, we are crying out for a bit of success to justify the commitment, the involvement, the passion. You know, it's all very well being all of those things, but you need to win something. You need to get somewhere, because we're in a competitive world. Mostly people that own football clubs are competitive people, and that's the problem, and it's also the solution.
Yeah, I mean, we're digressing from the list we were going to go through, but how different did you find when you came into football? You know, obviously, you were known for boxing and snooker, and with the boxing, I mean, from an outsider's point of view, you know, you've got two boxers, it's a pretty straightforward promotion job, you the purse is X, the crowd attendance, the TV money is this, and you know what you're going to roughly get out of it, and it's only one result, isn't it? You're either going to win, your fighter's going to win, or he's going to lose. How different was that for you to suddenly gauge and promote football?
I don't think anything could have prepared me. I went into Lake Norien ownership with absolutely zero experience in football, not particularly being passionate about football generally. I mean, I like Lake Norien because that was where I started and where, you know, it's a club that you warm to, but my knowledge was non-existent. You could have written it down on the back of a packet of fags, you know.
Yeah, and had room for a stamp, as they say.
Definitely.
Yeah.
You learn. I mean, you make loads of mistakes. You learn from your mistakes. You go forward. You know, you still got some basic principles. But it's unlike any other business because it is a fundamentally flawed business from a business sense. I mean, this is one of the reasons you can understand this Super League nonsense and how normal, sane people got carried away with the Super League concept, because it was fashioned out of normal business. Maximise your income, minimise your opposition, etc. You know, but of course, football isn't an ordinary business. It's not a business. It took me years to understand that whilst I was the owner, I was nothing like the owner, really. I was a steward, if you like, you know.
Yeah, you're a custodian, aren't you?
I was the custodian of the club. Now, that doesn't revolve around business principles, and that's why football isn't a business. And that's, again, is the joy of football, that it's, you know, beautifully...
Well, it's emotional, it gets emotive, it gets to you.
It's also a fundamental flaw of football, is because you've got competitive people running a business that's not really a business. The chairman generally leaves his brain in the car park when he parks his car, in a business sense. In emotional sense, you get much bigger highs when you have an occasional success than you would do normally in business. But there's so many more lows because the principles of how you run a business don't apply to football.
Right. Now, first of all, before we go any further with you, I think we haven't had a chance to speak to you all year, and congratulations on your OBE.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I trust you are curtsying, Andy, because I, you know...
Yeah.
It was. Listen, I'm old-fashioned as well, so it's double bubble, really. I was chuffed to bits, you know. It's been a long time.
So have you got it yet? Have you got it yet, or you got to wait?
No, I mean, apparently there is a massive COVID queue, so, you know, I'll probably end up with a call giving it to me because they'll be trying to get rid of so many medals on one day. But, no, I was very honoured, and it was gratefully received. Nothing more, nothing less.
Yeah, because yourself and Errol, of course, as he's got an MBE, so it's good for the Orient crowd to see people getting honoured. Oh. But, I mean... With you, I think you're quite a fascinating person, really, when you start looking through things, because everyone likes a success story, and I suppose to a point, the British love to knock people down. If you were in America, you'd be sort of hailed as a success story, because, you know, you have come from very humble beginnings, haven't you, really?
Well, yeah. I mean, I came from beginnings, and that's, you know, I didn't know at the time when I was young that they were humble, because you just, kids get used to what they've got, haven't they? But I like to think, although I've done pretty good so far, I like to think I still remember where I came from and I keep my feet on the floor. I've got a wife that makes sure that happens anyway, because if I get carried away, she soon gives me a rollicking, so it's not a problem. But, you know, yeah, I enjoyed, I think, well, you know, the way you're brought up, the way you come from sort of begins your process of life, and the type of person you are is governed by parents and environment, you know, and certainly, you know, I was a working class family, and I still think working class, even, you know, even if I've got a few quid more than my family had when I was born. My dad was a bus driver. My mum cleaned houses.
Yeah.
But I mean, it only makes me appreciate what I've got now. And, you know, it was nice because it was my mum who said I had to go to Lake Norham when I was 11 because I wanted to go and see a football match because all the other kids in school were going and I wasn't. And she wouldn't let me go to anywhere other than Lake Norham. I didn't know the name. And she said, oh, no, Lake Norham. It's a nice, friendly family club, that is. You can't go to Spurs or Arsenal or West Ham. And that was, as most kids, we just do what our mum tells us, don't we? So for 19 years of ownership, I've got her to blame, I think.
Yeah. I mean, do you thought yourself as a little bit different to the other kids? Because you started sort of business ideas, washing cars and picking fruit and things like that, very young. So did you not mix so much with the other kids, or was there a reason?
No, I'm not necessarily. I was never a loner, but at the same time, I was very focused. I mean, from a very young age, I don't know, say 10, 11, 12, by then you're sort of mature enough to look around and see, bloody hell, you know, we're skint. And you look up the big houses on the hill, see, well, you know, what have you got to do to get one of them, you know? And then there's two or three paths in life, aren't there? There's a good way to get it, there's a bad way to get it, and so on. And I had a very strict mother, and she forced, you know, she instilled good standards, I think. But I always wanted things. I wasn't jealous. I just wanted the same as other people.
Ambitious, rather than jealous.
Yeah. And I realised early doors that not being a genius, which I'm not, was hard work was probably the easiest way to get a few quid. Because if you put more hours in, you generally got more for it. So whether you were picking fruit, picking potatoes, hot picking, whatever, you know, washing cars, it didn't matter. If you put the hours in, you got more money. And that triggered onto me quite early, and I think the work ethic made me successful. You know, whereas other people might have stopped when they got to a certain stage, I pushed on, and I've been like that from a very, very young age.
So
I just wanted things.
You got an accountancy.
Where a lot of kids were quite rich.
Yeah. You got into
wealthy families.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think I probably got a bit of a chip on my shoulder early doors. You know, why them, not us, and all that. And my dad died early, so. You know, there wasn't a question of going to university or anything like that. I had to go out to work. But, no, I was always ambitious and always didn't mind putting in graft. And I think I've kept that up. And I think even my children, although they were born in an entirely different environment, have still got that work ethic that I'm very proud of, because despite what they've got, they graft their nuts off, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you got into accountancy, didn't you? So, and that was your start, I suppose.
Yeah.
And, you know, you then, what made you, I mean, just looked on your Wikipedia for a little bit of reference, obviously, and they say you went into property, but what made you think about a snooker hall as the property to invest in?
Well, these things happen, I think. No matter how bright you are, you need a bit of luck. You need to be in the right place at the right time. And I got headhunted by a company to be their financial director, so I left accountancy and went into the commercial world. One of the things that I suggested we invested in was a chain of snooker halls, because they had great property, you know, high street property, whether it was above Burton's or in town centres. So it had a good asset base, the company. But what I didn't know was, within a year of us buying these snooker halls, that the BBC was suddenly going to put snooker on mainstream television and make the sport massive, which they did.
And they did.
I was in the right place at the right time, got lucky. The secret of getting lucky and being in the right place is to maximise your luck, you know. So the work starts after you got lucky, but you need that opportunity first.
I'm trying to remember the Lucania. I think it was around the corner to the cinema, wasn't it, in Romford?
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, just around South Street in Romford.
Yeah.
There's one in Barkingside, there's one in Dagenham. I mean, we had them all over the place, but you know, they were nice. But I enjoyed it because it was just, you felt like you was in almost at home there, you know, especially during the days, either in the betting shop or on the billiard hall. And But it was a good business, and it, you know, it exploded with, as I say, with BBC interest, and suddenly I was a smart genius kid that got lucky. But I didn't tell anyone it was a fluke. I told them I was a smart genius.
Hi, Barry. It's Barry. Barry Gowan. Hey, how are you doing? All right?
Good, mate.
Yeah, I just want to, and you just mentioned the Luciana in South Street in Romford.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to confess something. Like 30-odd years later, me and a couple of mates broke your track and field machine, and we got barred.
So
I owe you a few quid, mate.
No, not me, man, because I still own the building, but I rent it out. So
okay, well, I do owe you a couple of quid, because we broke it and your man chased us out the door, and it's always weighed on me, and every time I've seen you, I wanted to admit, I get it off my chest. It was about 1984 when I was about 14.
Oh, we're 14. Yeah. We'll do crazy things when we're 14. Just
thanks, mate. Am I forgiven?
Yeah.
Sorry, but when Andy said it, I just had to get it off my chest. Yeah, thank you.
I think, like every good Roman Catholic will tell you, that, you know, going to confession is the first part of curing the sin.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, mate.
Four Hail Marys and whatever else.
I'm released.
Off you go. Off you go.
Yeah. No, two TOR taxis out. You know, think that twice, and then we'll let you off.
Yeah. So, I mean, your early success there, I mean, it came with, you know, you met Steve. How did you meet Steve Davis?
He just turned up to play. I started organising snooker events because I wanted to get more customers in, and I thought a snooker event would do it. And Steve just turned up because he wanted to play in that particular event. So, you know, I can't say I thought he was going to be the greatest player in the world when I first saw him. But over a period of time, obviously, he had some special talent, and we developed eventually a very close friendship. I mean, he's still my best mate now, 45 years now. So, you know, I can't get rid of him now.
No.
We're like an old married couple, but we don't talk as much as we used to. We don't see each other as much as we used to. But
he works very hard.
We're there when each other needs us, which is nice. That's a good friendship.
He's on his station, you know that, don't you?
I know. He works so into music.
He works so hard. The other week he played 7 records in 2 hours.
I know. He's just unbelievable. I mean, but he's so passionate about that.
Yeah.
I take my hat off to him because he's gone from one life to a completely different life, and something that I could never do. You know, I mean, I might play around like now, play a bit more cricket, play a bit more golf, go a bit fishing, but I can't still change the person I am. But he's actually changed into this music guru, and he's loving every second of it. It's great to see someone so content with their lot, you know?
Yeah, I think, to be fair, I think we're, from an outsider looking in, your talent lies in spotting the opportunities that basically others bypass, because snooker to most of us was, you know, we had the sort of Fred and Joe Davis and old people playing it, and it was smoky old billiard halls, and it suddenly, as you say, it's gone on television, and you've got this Matchroom squad together. You even had a hit record with Chaz and Dave, which was not a bad effort.
The pops, Andy.
Yeah, I know you were. I remember the video.
Oh, yeah. It was cool. It was so cool.
Yeah.
My kids were so impressed. I said, Dad, you're the only dad at our school that's in the top 10. And it was, But the type of thing you do is, in any environment, doesn't matter whether it's business or a football club, and I'm sure you look at it and you say, am I making the most of this? I mean, if you go back to Lake Norham, you know, that great story about when we bought the ground, and I looked at it and thought, I don't need the four corners. I haven't got a crowd big enough to field the four corners.
Mm.
And, you know, and suddenly, as you know, we bought the ground for 350,000 quid off the council. Within 18 months, we sold the four corners for like 8.5 million quid.
Yeah.
You know, and all that was doing was the principle there, same as when you do a sport, is you look at a situation and say, how can we do better? How can we make more? Is there something, is there an angle that other people haven't come in at? Can we, you know, and with snooker, we made everybody into sort of soap stars, reality stars almost, you know, they all had their own personality. We developed a following on the back of great television coverage, and they became famous. And when you come back, I'm famous, it's a lot easier to make a living. And the Orient one was like, you know, were we going to just have money flying out of Orient every month, or should we do something where we can be self-sufficient and not borrow money like every other football club? And that's what we did, and we ended up building 3 sides of a stadium. Mm. I know you've got a new roof on the east end now, thank goodness. But, you know, there's thinking smart and thinking poor.
Having said that, Barry, your critics will say we now play in a housing estate.
Yeah. Well, the critics can go and screw us, you know, because basically they've got no understanding about how you run a business.
Yeah.
The housing estate, I would always say, actually gives you atmosphere of having people around.
Mm.
And it makes it an integral part of the community, because the housing estate or the people in the flats are part of our community. And if we ever lose track of the community value of Leighton Orient, Leighton Orient will cease to exist, because it doesn't justify its existence any other way other than history and community. So, you know, people that look at it, and we always get fans say, oh, you know, you put those. Yeah, we did. But look at the ground. You know, and the smarter ones go, you know, we've got a ground as good as anything up to the championship, virtually, you know, I would think. And yet, we don't owe anybody any money. Because we thought smart. We thought smart. We didn't get ideas above our station. We kept our feet on the floor, and we had a little bit of working class poor thinking. We want to do this. We can't afford it. How are we going to do it? We think smart. And that's the rule of life in virtually every business you go into as well. If you don't think smart in business, you'd be out of business, wouldn't you? And then you'd be out of a job, and the people you employ would be out of a job. So think smart is much better than having, you know, these far-flung ideas of greatness which you can't sustain yourself.
Barry, it's Darren Burrows here. I'd like to ask you a question about thinking smart. That leads me nicely in. When you went for the Olympics, what was the smart thinking behind that? Because my understanding was that you wanted to turn it into a 25,000 all-seater without the running track, and they wouldn't budge on that, yeah. And that's why you walked away.
Yeah.
And it made sense to me to go for it. And what I also really enjoyed, and I'm a bit Machiavellian, but I really enjoyed the rivalry with West Ham that you stoked up. We didn't have it on the pitch.
Yeah, it's nice. It cost me a million quid in legal fees.
Well, there was that. We would have liked to see a bit of that on the transfer market instead, but I got why you did it.
I got it because I felt, when I get upset, listen, I'm old school, when I get upset, there's no rules. So bollocks was the idea. But what we did was with it.
Watershed, Barry, watershed.
Okay, listen, I'm sorry about it. Put it out half the night.
But it's live.
The point about the Olympics was, originally the plan for that stadium was, Ken Livingstone, Tessa Jow's plan was, give it to Leighton Orient after the Olympics. Pull down the Meccano above the inner bowl, which is about a 20,000-seater, and give it to the community club. But then, of course, and I was like, day one, wow, this will do us. You know, I mean, it's not far away from Brisbane Road, and it's a purpose-built. So, but then of course Sebco and his athletics involvement, we got involved. Well, we've got to have an athletics track, and he seemed to sway everybody to say yes. The legacy is an athletics track, and I kept saying to everybody, it doesn't work in a football environment. This does not work. And I wasn't thinking about spending 20 million on retractable seating. By the way, I was just saying that football grounds I'd seen throughout Europe never worked with a track in front of them. No atmosphere. And I turned around to my line I actually used to the government in those days when they come out and said, well, you can still have it, but it's got to have an athletics track. And my line was, I don't dislike Leighton Orient fans enough to make them watch football behind an athletics track. I'm out.
For what it's worth, I personally think you got it right, because...
Yeah, but I got it right, but they got it wrong. We had an opportunity. Even the athletics people, to this day, they don't really want... There's only two athletics meetings a year. It was one of the worst ideas of all time to keep. I mean, it's caused West Ham problems. It's bankrupted various organisations trying to run the London Stadium. Because it's one of those, you know, we talk about football being fundamentally flawed. The whole of that stadium has been fundamentally flawed from day one. And it has resulted in a massive bill for the taxpayer, a huge state sponsorship of West Ham in terms of, here's a stadium for virtually nothing that costs 700 million. You know, the competitors, Arsenal, Tottenham in particular, should be really furious that a competitor of theirs has had all this asset delivered. Even the rental doesn't even pay the overheads, and it never will. So it was basically, and good luck to West Ham. Let me make that quite clear. If I could have taken someone's trousers down like that, I would have done as well. So I'm just jealous, all right?
How frustrating, Barry, is that? I mean, it's what grinds with me is that the £40 million that was subsidised to them to allow them to get into the stadium, and we know that's gone through a different companies, etc. But, you know, the reading is it's highly unlikely to be able to be paid back. And
yet,
they can buy players.
The whole thing is totally bankrupt. It's not £40 million. That stadium cost £700 million, and West Ham paid £15 million quid.
Mm. No, it's a 40 million they borrowed from, was it Newham or through a, whatever it was, through a number of companies.
That was a grant from Newham Borough Council that wanted to be friendly with West Ham. You know, we could actually talk about it for days because I still, what I wanted to do quite simply was, and I wasn't bothered about West Ham, and you won't agree with this or you may not, and fans won't agree. Had we moved into a 20,000 Olympic stadium, initial plan without a running track, we would have developed Brisbane Road, we would have stuck the money into Orion, we'd have given away 20,000, 10,000 free tickets a week, don't care, gate money's incidental. We would have had an opportunity there, potentially, to build a big club. And then, you know, look, I'm in business as well. I'm an Orion fan, trust me, but I'm also in business and I'm not stupid. There is no future other than losing money unless you are at least in the championship. And even that's difficult. Even that's difficult. We could have had a chance. To the same, I would have shared with West Ham. I really would have shared with West Ham. And a lot of fans would go, well, I know that. I understand the emotion, but I'm talking about if you were really trying to get somewhere.
To be honest with you, Barry, we were fine. Personally, all the fans I knew, pretty much, we were fine with sharing a stadium.
Yeah.
And I think everything you said, it's good to get clarity on that. I do personally, to this day, hold a grudge against Karen Brady.
Well,
because I spoke the way she spoke about our great club.
Listen, Karen's a tough cookie, right? She's a tough old cookie. I won't say good things, I won't say bad things. I'm going to be neutral. But what I can say is, she did a great job for West Ham.
She did. That is undeniable. I just took a bit personal exception of what she said.
Did she do a great job for the country, Baroness Brady? No. Did she do a great job for the taxpayer? No. She did a very good job for her
employees. Yeah.
And you can't knock that. Was it something that should have been allowed to happen by the government? Absolutely not.
And she's not a fault for that, is she? Like you say, she did a good job for her business.
She did her job.
Yeah, I mean, I
don't agree with how she did it. I don't agree. I think she bullied. I think it wasn't a fair fight.
No.
Karen Brady is a good operator. And to put her up against the civil servants that were appointed by the government to handle the London Stadium, I saw them in action. It wasn't a fair fight. I went to see Boris Johnson myself and said, Boris, let me do the negotiation for you. I will do it free because it's not a fair fight. Your people are not good enough. But they wouldn't have it. And, of course, Karen, being the operator she is, blew them away.
I mean, she didn't even know the residual value of the ground at Upton Park, according to the Select Committee. And you're sitting there in open mouth, in befuddlement, thinking a CEO doesn't actually know.
She knew everything. Don't worry about that.
Obviously.
I went to that House of Lords thing with her. We were both on at the same day to the Select Committee. But she was brilliant because every time she had a question she didn't want to answer, she just said, I'm bound by confidentiality. I can't answer that question.
Mm.
It was a waste of time having her in there. But she did her job.
It was.
West Ham, the paymasters. You can't knock that. But the fault of anything lies with the government, in particular with Boris Johnson, who was Mayor of London at the time. He wanted the London Stadium off his desk. He just wanted to get rid of it. And they did a dreadful deal. And you will find out over, if you don't know already, but over the months to follow from today, over the next 12 months, you will see the plight of that stadium again and again because the whole basis of its funding and its operation is fundamentally flawed by either poor design or poor contractual negotiations.
Yeah.
It's a dead duck, but for West Ham, it has enhanced the value of West Ham enormously while the taxpayers picking up the bill.
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing you one evening, you came back from seeing Mr. Johnson, and I don't think I've ever seen you so frustrated, actually.
Well, no, I was perplexed, because what to me is common sense, and doesn't require an enormous business acumen, but it is, most business decisions are common sense. We try to make them sound good, but it's just, there was very little, if any, common sense, other than get this problem off my desk.
Mm.
And that's not a way to solve a problem, especially when it has long-term implications to taxpayers and general funding. a Newham Borough Council that have advanced the $40 million or whatever as part of the package may have to answer to themselves. But like everything else, when it turns round in full circle, the people in charge when it all goes tits up are not the people that made the decision. It's successive governments, you know. They can always blame the previous incumbent, you know. So I'm not looking for satisfaction on it. I would still treasure the dream that one day, you know, Orient could go there. And I don't think it's going to happen now. But, you know, I think that had we got the ability to have that postal address, the enhanced, effectively, intellectual property value of Leighton Orient would have blossomed, and it would have encouraged more investment.
Yeah.
And you could actually see the way of, I know this sounds crazy, you could see the way of progression through the leagues a lot easier. Because similarly, West Ham appeal is far greater to overseas investors, for example, than it was when they were at Upton Park.
You know? Yeah. I mean, you said about the, you know, London Orient at one point, didn't you, and the possibilities of selling overseas. And obviously, at the moment, Nigel and Kent are busy trying to negotiate and get things promoted overseas and overseas investors involved with the club, etc.
Yeah, and they're doing a good job, but it's hard for them. I mean, they're both very intelligent people, very smart people, and they love Orient.
Yeah, but would a 45-year-old Barry Hearn get involved with the Leighton Orient now if he could walk back through the door, if the situation was with football as it is today? Would you?
I mean, listen, I had loads of grief there, as you know. You remember all the days. Wasn't the fans' favourite a lot of the time. Didn't really give a monkey, but that was okay. but it's funny. I said to someone the other day, when the good Lord takes you and you're laying on that bench and you're about to go up to the pearly gates, and someone says, little archangel says, give me 10 great moments of your life. I've had a very interesting life and I've had some great moments. Outside of family, let's leave out wives and children for a second. At least 4 of those 10 will be Leighton Orient, which is unbelievable. I've done hundreds of thousands of events, some of the biggest sports events in the world. 4 of those will be Leighton Orient, at least. That's why. It's such a stupid job. Being chairman of a football club is the worst job in the world. And yet, I wouldn't swap a day of it.
I mean, I was just behind you at Oxford.
One of them. I mean, that's number one.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, yeah, without sounding patronising to you, you know, forget the fact you've got a few bob, etc. I looked down and it was just so natural, the genuine excitement and thrill, and the fact that there was you, I think Matt Poulter had missed the winning goal, but he just got back in time, and Steve Dawson, and literally jumping up and down in the circle.
My father-in-law was there, my wife was there, my son was there, my daughter.
Apart from your rendition of Viva Las Vegas, which we won't mention,
but I appreciate that. But
yeah, it was genuine excitement, wasn't it?
If you haven't got, this is why the Super League thing went all pear-shaped, because they forgot about the passion. You can't forget about passion in sport, whatever sport you follow. And football, there's nothing more passionate than following your own team, because it's years of frustration or it's months of sadness. But it only takes one day, one game, one goal. You know, when you watch Jonathan Toure jink between two Arsenal defenders and smash the ball into the left-hand corner underneath the hapless Almunia in goal for Arsenal.
You should be a commentator with that.
Yeah, but that's one of the greatest moments of my life.
Yeah.
And yet, why? I mean, all right, we took $1.4 million on the gate going to Arsenal. That was, I think, the only year of 19 years we actually made a profit. We made 400 grand instead of losing a million. Happy days. But it wasn't that. It was the fact that we were going, you know, we'd held Arsenal to a draw.
Yeah.
You know, and it was
a great achievement.
And,
yeah.
And we created memories that day for everybody who's in that ground that we'll never forget. They might forget the names of their children when they're older, but they will never forget the 88th-minute equaliser. They will never forget shouting at the referee to blow the dot-dot-dot whistle as we had 3 minutes of injury time and we're all in danger of not getting to the toilet fast enough, you know?
Yeah. It still gives you goosebumps, that moment. On YouTube, you still see it, and
I watch it quite often.
Yeah.
I don't have bad days in my life. I don't allow bad days. If I ever have a slightly off day, then I'll watch the highlights of the Oxford game, and I'll watch that goal going in against Arsenal.
And Russell's hat coming off, that's just, that was the icing on the cake when he ran down a touchline.
I'll do Matty Lockwood's goal against Hull in the playoffs, and then I'll do the highlights of the Peterborough semi-final. You know, those are the sort of days which, you know, my family's quite down to earth as well. When we walked out of Wembley the first time and played Scunthorpe under my tenure, my custodianship, I turned around to my wife with 25,000 Orient fans and said, whatever I spend on this football club, because I get criticised, you know, why are you wasting that? Why are you doing this? Whatever I spend, I've had my money's worth today. And that's, football goes beyond money. And that's a sadness as well as a plus, you know, because you do get silly. I mean, under Tommy Taylor, I think I had 36 players in the squad at one stage. I'm like, Tommy, why? There's only 11 on the pitch, isn't there?
Just
need one more chairman. Well, I loved him for it, but you make decisions that you wouldn't make in any other life in football.
You hear rumours. Did you actually get rid of a player and tell him he'd never play again and take the money and run? When he committed,
a few times.
Yeah, I mean, what's his name now? Dave.
Oh yeah.
Hanson, was it?
No, not Dave Hanson. Hanson. Yeah, no, Dave wasn't. There was a couple.
Dave Martin. Yeah. That's it. Dave Martin.
Well,
that's
Dave
it.
Dave Martin. I think we signed him, and he's a lovely man. Had been a very good player, but his legs have gone, and I think he didn't really want to be there. But
he did a terrible foul, didn't he? If I remember rightly, and it was a horrendous challenge, and he got sent off. And I remember rightly, there was all, even the Orient fans were booing him, etc. And he never played again for the club.
No, I think it was just I mean, sometimes it's just not right. We've had a few during the Bichetti ownership. Who really didn't necessarily want to be out there, but were quite happy to be paid.
That's two B words you said now, Barry. You said the naughty one, you said the Italian one as well.
Yeah,
so
you
get fined for both of them. Can I ask you a question, Barry? Earlier on you said no regrets, and I totally understand that in life, but let me rephrase it. If you could do anything differently in your sporting tenure that you've had, including any sport that you do, what's the one thing you would have done differently if you'd have had the chance to do it again? The main one.
You want me to say sell the club to Bichetti, but
I don't know. I wasn't leading you there, but that's a good one.
I would have done that every day of the week at the time, at that moment of doing the deal, because I knew he was going to put a load of money in. I didn't know
for the right reasons.
I didn't know he didn't know what he was doing.
None of us did.
But he did put 13 million quid into Leighton Orient, and he told me to my face, "I will put money in to make this club successful," and he did exactly what he said.
Just the second bit didn't happen.
He didn't listen to anybody, and he was completely mad. But, you know, okay, he'd done his own money, and it wasn't the same. But you can only judge a decision at the point that you made the decision rather than retrospective, because hindsight makes us all experts, you know?
Yeah. What we'll say about you, Barry, is that the listeners, mate, you know, people have got opinions of you, and some people, you know, I think it's fair to say you're Marmite, aren't you? Some people like you, and some people don't.
Really care, to be honest.
Yeah, I know that, but I think it's a fair thing because people are warm to you, and people think, you know, there's different sorts of people who got their own views of you and everything. But I've said that I've been to your place over the years to record videos, etc. And every time I've turned up, over a period of maybe 30 years, the staff remained the same. And I said, now that to me, I said, we forget what people say, you know, in the crowd and things like that. I said, that speaks to me volumes, that there is a loyalty, two-way loyalty there. That
people make uninformed comments, Andy, because they don't really know you. I mean, I have a characterisation in me that I sometimes use to my benefit. I put it on a bit sometimes. I can be the chirpy Cockney chappy if I want to be, or I can be Lord Muck if I want to be. I'm a salesman, and basically that's how I've sold my ideas to people and run businesses accordingly. But the difference is, when you do know me, and people that know me are people who work for me, they know me better than anyone else because they see me more, and they see me on good days, bad days and whatever. So they make their own judgment. In my business, I never see anything but smiles, and I never hear anything but laughter. And that's why people stay with me forever, because I'm a good person.
Yeah.
But you don't get a brownie point by telling people I'm a good person.
No. So no, but proof is in the pudding, isn't it?
Yeah, you do. You do what you want to do for yourself, for your own peace of mind. I like being a good person. It's not in my business. I don't want to be known as a good person, because I've got to be a rascal sometimes. I've got to be a nasty person sometimes, because I'm dealing with rascals and nasty persons.
Yeah, I mean, you've had to stand your ground. I mean, you even withdrew the fighters before a fight, didn't you? Because you didn't think the money was there for...
Well, the money wasn't there. I wasn't going to get paid, and I wasn't going to get one of my kids hurt for the sake of someone else's trying to profit on their activity without putting the money in. So, no, you've got to have principles. You've got to have some principles. And I think, actually, we have. And I think, in a funny way, Leighton Orient as a football club's got principles.
Hmm. So you're a man who demands loyalty, but to provide it back the other way. Would that be a fair assumption?
It's never demanded. It's only ever earned, you know.
Well, I'd say demand loyalty, but you would hope, you would expect some loyalty back, wouldn't you?
I'd say to people, do what you like. Show me what you want. Show me who you are. Do you want to have a career? Show me. Do you want to be successful? Show me you want it. If you want it bad enough, you'll get it. If you don't want it, I don't really want you in the building.
Now, you know, you just recently I'll just say you retired, because I can't say you'd ever retire, I don't think, 100%, would you?
No, I'm sort of, I'm involved with advice now. I've got better operators than me, Andy. You know, the Matt Paulers of this world on the darts, the Eddie on the boxing, Frank Smith on the boxing, Emily Fraser on multisport, Steve Dawson. I've got some brilliant, brilliant young people. They deserve their head. Let them go and do their... Show me what you can do. And secondly is, they're better than me. They're in today's technological world. I know, I'm okay as a face. I'm okay as a spokesman or an ambassador. I'm okay travelling around the world, meeting people, because I know a lot of people in the industry. I can be useful. But from an operational standpoint, I'm yesterday's news. And you have to always look in the mirror and tell yourself the truth. I reached my sell-by date. I reached my sell-by date with Leighton Orient after 19 years. It wasn't an age thing, it was a mental thing. I'd realised enough, I knew enough about football to know this sport was not going to be good for me in the long term. Didn't stop me being a fan, but it stopped me realising you can't kill yourself trying to do something which is not going to be possible.
Terry, you mentioned about it being a steep learning curve for you when you come in and bought the club.
Yeah.
And I remind you about the time when we sold Paul Hill to Wimbledon, and Wimbledon played up that he was going to be their third choice keeper. And and then they ran a story, didn't they? Or they didn't run, but there was a story about how they'd got this snip. And can you give us sort of some backgrounds and sort of the kind of lessons you learned quickly, and how that changed how you run the club and how you thought about football?
Well, Wimbledon was Sam the Man at the time, wasn't he?
Yes.
You know, you couldn't get a shilling out of Sam the Man. His tie is working on two legs. I think Paul Hill probably left actually just before I came, or as I came. In time, like everything else, when you know the value of something or you've got a better idea, you do better deals. You know, when we sold Gabriel Zakuani to Fulham, Fulham wanted to pay £500,000, and the board said yes, and I said no. I said, I think Fulham really want him, and if they really want him, they will pay £1 million. And everyone said I was mad, and Fulham paid £1 million, and they played him one game, if you remember. One game.
We do.
And that was only in the League Cup, or the version of the League Cup. And similarly, when we sold Moses Adebuju to... Brentford, I think it was, the £1 million was the right price. Sometimes it's not a question of what the player is worth to a football.
And when you
it's what someone will pay to get them, you know, and they're two different equations.
When you were in charge, Barry, the club, one thing that I think sort of a few of us fans struggle with now is there's a transfer committee. How did it work when you run Leighton Orient, Barry? Would the manager come to you and say, I want to sign this player, can I have him?
And the manager always, pretty well always, got his own way, because I don't believe in having a manager and then manage yourself. And also, I don't believe that I had anywhere near enough knowledge to make the selections. And sometimes managers get it right and sometimes get it wrong. And that sometimes manager lasts 5 years and sometimes managers last a year.
Hi, Barry, it's Joe here. Just on what you were saying, did you ever see a player turn out the shirt and think, what has the manager actually seen in that player want to sign him in the first instance?
Dozens of times. What on earth have we got here?
Would you care to name names?
No. Of course, it wouldn't be fair on them, would it? But listen, the trouble is about being the chairman is you might be called the chairman, but you're still really a fan. So I've got as many stupid ideas on how to run a football club or what a player's playing out of position than you have as a fan. And we're all wrong, because the only one who makes the decision really should be the manager. I've never been a fan of rule by committee, you know. I like people to be responsible. If they get it right, they deserve reward. If they get it wrong, they deserve the sack. You know, we're in the results business, aren't we?
But there's times
when you have an opinion. I mean, probably our greatest manager, I have to say Russell Slade under my tenure, you know. But Tommy Taylor was up there as a bloke's bloke, who I liked enormously. And Martin Ling was a good manager as well. But Russell Slade, probably I'd give the edge to, simply on his work ethic, in terms of he actually lived the job 24 hours a day, in the same way that in my life I've lived my job 24 hours a day.
And Barry, you quite rightly didn't want to comment on some of the players that you didn't rate, but would you care to name a few that you did in your tenure, you know, your favourite players that you worked with and saw playing for the Orient?
Matty Lockwood was right up there, one of my favourite all-time players, without a doubt.
John Mackie
was right up there as one of my favourite all-time people. I like to see, again, it's different, people got different choices. I like people, if I was in the trenches with them, I could rely on them, you know. And the team that won at Oxford were full of those characters.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I'm also old-fashioned, and by the way, I hate all this passing on the back line for 10 minutes. You know, I like speedy wingers down the outside and big centre-forwards in the middle who've got a bit of pace. You know, I like pace. I like pace in everything I do in my life. I like pace when I watch football. I find it exciting.
Do you want to be the manager of Leyton Orient then, Barry, because there's a position available?
Football should be entertaining. You know, I mean, again, I don't want to lose 5-3, but I'd rather, you know, I can only watch so many 0-0 draws. I can only watch so much possession football. Because, again, we're playing the same. Possession football is the same as they play in the Premiership, but we don't have the players with the skill that plays that in the Premiership. So just, you can't just copy something, you have to adapt. You have to adapt to the league you're in. And, you know, we've seen plenty of managers with Buda, like Norrin, play the high ball down the middle, kick the ball off for a throw-in from the kick-off and all that. They're playing their tactics to get the results they want. And you dream that one day you might play proper football. But for me, I'm a little bit more old-fashioned, and I'm not, as I say, you can't take any notice of me when I talk about football, because I don't really know what I'm talking about. I enjoy what I want to see, but I like results as well.
Barry, there was I always felt as a fan, it took you a bit of time to adjust. We spoke about this off-air earlier. And
only 19 years.
Sorry, Barry?
Only 19 years.
No, you got it right a lot of time of managers, but there was one or two, and there was one famously, we lost 3-0 away to Huddersfield. We were pretty dire, and I think you informed him on the team bus. Do you remember that? Who that manager was? Would you say that was a bit harsh, Barry, and perhaps you look back and think we should let him at least get home first, or do you think that?
I don't know. I can't say. I think you change as well when you get a little bit older. You know, I was probably more, some people will say more positive, other people will say more irrational, you know, depending on your interpretation. I can't remember the manager you're talking about now.
It was Pat Holland.
Yeah, but I think Pat had already been told beforehand that, you know, things weren't going too well. I mean, he was a nice man. Probably I gave him a job without knowing so much about football. Not to say that we could have got lucky. You know, someone gave Eddie Howe a job once, the same sort of thing, you know, and he ended up being a great manager. So,
actually, we're going to be standing corrected. We think it was Paul Brush. It was Paul Brush.
Okay, well, whoever went, one thing you can be sure of is that my mind had probably been, well, definitely would have been made up before the game.
Yeah.
Because that would have just been...
Barry, can I just say, take it away from the football a minute, because obviously, yeah, you had a little bit of a health issue, and no secret, you've had a bit of a heart problem here and there. Has that changed you as a person?
No, not at all.
Not at all? You don't have a different outlook at all?
Not one single modicum, no.
And the staff must like you, because didn't they buy you a defibrillator for your birthday?
For my birthday. They bought me two llamas the year before. The year before that, they bought me a flagpole. The year before that, they bought me some peacocks. And then they bought me a defibrillator. I was like, someone's trying to get rid of me. No, listen, I mean, it's a way of life. Fortunately, Basil and Cardiac are brilliant. So it wasn't an issue. It didn't concern me. I mean, because I'm a realist, and if he should die, he should die. But, I've always been fairly physically fit all my life. But, sometimes you get these issues, you just deal with them, don't you?
Yeah. Of course you do. One thing I will do, just coming away from football, and just going back in time a little bit to boxing, and I can never get over the fact, what did you say to convince so many people to depart with so much cash that an ageing boxer could beat Frank Bruno at White Hart Lane in Joe Bugner? I sat there and I thought, well, how did so many people fall for
this? It's easy. It's a soap opera, isn't it? You've got one of the nation's favourite sons, Frank Bruno. Everyone loved Frank. And then you add the villain. It's a pantomime. And sport so often is a pantomime. You know, this is why we all,
Barry's disagreeing with me. He thought Joe Bugner was good. I said, well,
Joe Bugner was good in his day. Aussie Joe had beaten
Aussie Joe
on a doubtful decision.
Yeah, 16 years before.
People didn't like him.
I'll tell you what, Andy, you wouldn't want to get in the ring with him even now. Joe, he'd give you some trouble, I tell you.
You wouldn't want to get in the ring with his old lady.
I remember. Right?
Yeah, she was a bruiser, wasn't she?
No, when I say it, when you're in the sports promotion business, you set out to entertain. So entertainment is not necessarily the best versus the best, because two donkeys can make a great race, but two personalities sell tickets, and that's what the world we live in now. You know, whether it's reality TV, in boxing we've got a fight coming up with one of the pound for pound all time greats fighting a YouTuber. Now. The boxing fan, like your hardcore Lake Norrin fan, criticise from a different perspective. What they don't see is the new fans coming in and saying, wow, this is something, and hopefully you attract a lot more people and you sell a lot of tickets. Hardcore fans only represent 10% of your audience at any one show. 90% are floating casual fans. And they're the ones, in today's commercial, are the ones you've got to appeal to.
Hi, Joe. Sorry, Barry, it's Joe again. I've been watching the thing on BBC Two about snooker in the
80s. Yeah, it's good,
and, isn't it? Yeah, it's been fantastic. And I, like a lot of people, really enjoyed snooker in the 80s. I've completely lost interest over time. What do you think has really caused the demise of snooker as the entertainment spectacle it was? And what chance are there ever getting back to the pinnacle that it... Sorry, say again?
The interesting thing about your comment there is that snooker is probably at least 10 times bigger now as a sport than it was in what people call the glory days. We are very parochial in our attitude in terms of we look at it with UK eyes, don't we? Because we're UK people. So the characters that we had in the 80s, they're no longer there. Have they been replaced by characters or not? But it's a UK perspective. Snooker is now a global game and it is at least 10, probably 20 times bigger than it's ever been before as a global sport. We've got much more interest from Southeast Asia, in particular China, Europe and Eastern Europe are there strong. Suddenly we've got strong American, South American business. So you're really looking at it from one side of the track. And I know because I was there were a lot of characters. The standard of the game today is, of course, far higher than it's ever been as well. The players that we are talking about in the 80s, probably, well, they wouldn't be in the top 32, most of them, of today's world, because the percentage miss rate and things like that, it's like looking at darts, when you talk about darts, how have you done that with darts? When Eric Bristow was winning the World Darts Championships in the 80s, early 90s, he would win with a three dart average in the high 80s. Or low 90s. Today, unless you average 110, you've got no chance.
What is it, Barry?
Sport moves on, and characters move on, and it's a different interpretation. But again, the whole world is different as well in terms of the proliferation of different TV channels. When we're talking, going back to then, we're talking pre-Sky, pre-BT, pre-Eurosport, different world.
Yeah, we're coming to the end of the show, Barry, but just what is it, what is the thing that you see in what were pretty mundane. I know a lot of people will knock me for it, but yeah. Mundane pub pastimes, you know, basically like...
I just look at it and think, would I personally find this entertaining? That's what I do.
You know, what do you see, to take it from, not being funny, a guy chucking darts at a dartboard with a fag in his hand to this razzmatazz that you've got now with thousands watching and millions on the television? I think, what a transformation.
It's been a fabulous journey. I've enjoyed every second of it. And I'm amazed that no one did it before me. And I don't think I'm a genius. I think I'm just, or maybe I am a genius. And I've never given myself credit. This is possible, Andy, because you know how modest I normally am.
You've always been.
I'm normally under. But it's just common sense. If you can find sports stroke pastimes, which are played by a volume audience, privately or in clubs or wherever, basically it's other people that have never taken the chance to say, I think we can make more of this. And there's a formula, and it does involve creating personalities, it does involve media, it does involve getting the right TV deals, it certainly involves getting a lot more money into the pockets of the players, because that spreads the gospel better than anything. It becomes aspirational, and you can do some amazing things if you keep telling people all the time, this is going to be an amazing thing. It's a bit like the king had no clothes. Eventually, the world will listen and say, he's really smartly dressed today.
Exactly. Barry, it's been a pleasure as always, and the master storyteller, isn't he, everybody? Mr. Barry Hearn.
Thank you.
And all the best to you and your family, Barry, and we'll catch up soon, I'm no doubt.
All the best to my family at Leighton Orient, and look forward to seeing you next season, which will undoubtedly be a promotion year.
Oh, please God. See you later, Barry. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was Barry Hearn, and as usual, good VFM, wasn't he, guys?
Yeah, great. Do you know what he said? He said in his interview himself, what I've always said about him, he's a salesman. Every time I meet him, he's a salesman, he's selling all the time, which is not a bad thing. He's a great guy.
He made you smile, Joe.
I did, yeah. He's certainly very engaging, and he's not without a story to tell.
He's not. Darren?
Yeah, we had Tommy Taylor on, didn't we, a while ago, and Tommy spoke incredibly highly of Barry, and Barry spoke incredibly highly of Tommy, and we've been lucky, Andy, over the years, and I use that word loosely because you make your own luck, and Barry, I think, would agree with that. We've had some great custodians, we've had some great people, and for me, Barry's up there.
Yep, well, we've got to make tracks, folks. Thanks to Joe, thanks to Barry, thanks to Darren, and thank you to you for listening, and this time next week, we should all know who the Orient manager is, I think, hopefully. See you later, folks.
Sign up to pump, it's Brisbane Road, it ain't White Hart Lane, that's the wrong postcode, it ain't Stamford Bridge. This is E10 and you're gonna hear rocking all over the world again. Cause there's flats in every corner of the ground, you can get your kids in just £5, get an Orient here, it's only a quid. It's an up-to-pump, it's Brisbane Road, it ain't White Hart Lane. That's a wrong postcode, it ain't Stamford Bridge. This is E10, and you're gonna hear rocking all over the world again. We had an FA Cup 78, we had John Sear, that is most irate. We were club reviver, but we don't care. Checkered Shirtley and Chris Tate's hair. I remember the moment the league spill scored. I remember it's done on the message board. I remember the pleasure, I remember the pain, and I wanna hear rocking all over the world again. It's St Upton Park, it's Brisbane Road, it ain't White Hart Lane. That's the wrong postcode, it ain't Stamford Bridge. This is E10, and you're gonna hear rocking all over the world again.
On the hour, across Brentwood and Billericay, this is Phoenix FM News.